We just need to make it clear to them that this needs to be really carefully thought through.
Protesting the Navy training exercise in the Gulf of Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, wedding vows for Don Young on his 82nd birthday.
I think she's sillier than hell to marry me and be right up front with you. I asked her and she said yes, and so that's the way it goes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
House and Senate budget negotiators have agreed to fully fund the per-student funding formula for the coming year as work continues on efforts to reach an overall budget deal. The conference committee agreed to the provision today. Other items before the committee include whether to honor cost-of-living increases in negotiated union contracts. That remains unresolved. Funding for the pay increases has been a sticking point in budget talks. Democratic Representative Les Guerra says he's hopeful a resolution can be reached soon. The new fiscal year starts July 1st. Republican House Finance Committee co-chair Mark Newman says a tremendous amount of work has been happening behind the scenes to try to find a compromise. The Sierra Club is claiming a victory for environmentalists opposed to Seward coal shipments. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
According to Meg Matthews, a Sierra Club spokesperson, the United States Supreme Court has declined to hear an appeal by Aurora Energy Services and the Alaska Railroad regarding a lower court decision on a clean water permit. Aurora and the railroad operate a coal loading facility in Seward for export purposes. The environmental group, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, has long complained that the coal export process is responsible for dumping coal and debris into Resurrection Bay. Pam Miller, executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, says her organization and the Sierra Club brought legal action against the coal facility.
Original action that we brought was really an attempt to stop the coal facility from dumping coal into Resurrection Bay and creating what we think is not only an environmental hazard but also a public health hazard, because the coal stockpiles there also emit large amounts of dust that are creating a public health threat. So we brought a case in an attempt to get them to put the proper controls in place that would prevent that from happening.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found in favor of the plaintiffs last September, deciding that Aurora's stormwater discharge permit does not allow dumping coal into the bay. Miller says the decision means Aurora is required to go through a Clean Water Act permitting system that goes out for public review, which is what ACAT wanted in the first place. But Aurora spokesperson Lorelei Simon says the outcome of the lawsuit and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision not to hear an appeal changes little. Simon says the coal facility has been inspected by the federal EPA and the state DEC many times over the years, and both agencies understand that there is incidental spill off the conveyor belt.
So where we are now is the facility has been going through the permitting process with the State Department of Environmental Conservation to secure an individual permit. So it's important to keep in mind that there's no difference in environmental impact.
Simon says the coal loading facility has been operating under a compliance order with the state of Alaska, during which time the facility has undergone upgrades while the permit process is going on. Aurora and the railroad filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, Simon says, because the Ninth Circuit decision conflicts with a decision by the Sixth Circuit Court in a similar case. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Several coastal communities, including Kodiak, Cordova, and Homer, have held both land-based and fishing boat flotilla protests over the last few weeks to voice their concerns about planned Navy and joint military training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver went to the protest in Homer on Friday.
Dozens of local residents ignored the strong winds, gray skies, and drizzle to gather around the Mariners' memorial on the Homer Spit. Jess Tenhoff is struggling with a large paper sign against the wind that reads, "Nurture, not Navy."
Well, I think the Navy could nurture, you know? Personally, I would like it if the Navy would take the lead in nurturing, which it seems like they should do, considering that they make their living off the ocean. You know, they should be the ones most concerned. And I'm hoping that they are, you know, and that we just need to make it clear to them that this needs to be really carefully thought through.
She's referring to a series of planned training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska by the Navy. Last fall, the comment period closed on a draft environmental impact statement, or EIS, for the next phase of the training starting in 2016. In the EIS, the Navy outlined the type of activities that could potentially have an effect on marine life. They included underwater explosions, simulated weapons fire, high ship and aircraft traffic, and sonar. The Navy's operations are related to the joint training called Northern Edge that brings together other branches of the military. It began in the early 90s and has roots in projects like Jack Frost and Brim Frost dating back to the 70s. U.S. Air Force Captain Anastasia Wassum is the Public Affairs Director for Northern Edge.
We're aware of the protest, and we've even scheduled several public meetings to help alleviate the concerns of people in those areas.
She says representatives from Alaskan Command and other organizations are traveling to Cordova and Kodiak to meet with residents, and that they are sensitive to concerns.
And if the public has concerns about the exercise, we certainly want them to be able to voice those concerns and be able to contact us. And my office is always more than happy to speak with anybody about Northern Edge.
Several protesters say they appreciate the ability to offer comments, but are concerned they aren't having any effect. But all they're asking for right now is that the military seriously consider its trainings in the Gulf of Alaska and not purposefully take part in activities that could harm this sensitive ecosystem. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska Congressman Don Young tied the knot today on his 82nd birthday. Young married 76-year-old Ann Walton, a flight nurse from Fairbanks, this afternoon. APRN's Liz Ruskin met up with them afterward.
The House chaplain married them in a little prayer room near the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. Later, at his congressional office, Young was smiling ear to ear, still wearing a pink rose on his lapel.
I think she's sillier than hell to marry me and be right up front with you. I asked her, and she said yes, and so that's the way it goes. And that's, we got this, we're partners.
Both bride and groom are parents and grandparents who were widowed, he in 2009, she in 2001. Walton, who will keep her last name, says finding each other was a gift from God. Marrying on Young's birthday, on the other hand, the bride says that was calculated.
Absolutely. It was totally planned. And the plan was that if we did it on his birthday, the chances of him ever forgetting our anniversary were just about nil. So now, forevermore, all of his birthday cakes will say, "Happy birthday, happy anniversary." Now, is that a plan or what?
Young, meanwhile, did a little jig in the office reception area because, he says, there aren't many 82-year-old grooms and fewer still who can dance on their wedding day. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a major benefactor to the Sitka Fine Arts Camp who gives and receives.
I don't know why it happened like this, but Sitka opened her hand.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration officially launched its Arctic survey season in Alaska yesterday. Two research ships, the Rainier and the Fairweather, will set out from Kodiak to chart the underwater and shoreline topography of the Arctic Ocean. NOAA communications specialist Don Forsyth says the mission is part of an ongoing effort to improve navigation in an area already experiencing increases to marine traffic.
So they collect all of this data over the summer, and then they'll send it on to eventually to the cartographers who will build new nautical charts or update old ones.
She says the updates are, in some cases, long overdue, recorded by Arctic explorers more than 100 years ago.
It's said that some of it dates back to Captain Cook's time. So, yeah, we're a little bit behind schedule.
But accurately mapping the Arctic is no easy task. Forsyth says it could take a century or more to chart all Arctic water in U.S. territory, so the ships will focus on priority areas for the 2015 season, including Point Clarence, Kotzebue Sound, and Point Hope. The research crews will use echo beams and underwater sonar to measure ocean depth and record navigational dangers. Those recordings will then be used to update existing charts or create new ones altogether. Forsyth says data gathered this summer will be incorporated into public charts and electronic navigational software as early as next year. The first load of wood bison bulls has been successfully released into the wild in the Onoco River Valley. Late last month, 12 bulls traveled by barge in special air-conditioned containers from Nenana to the unloading site, several miles upriver from the village of Shagaluk, where a group of cows and calves has been roaming since April. Wood bison restoration project manager Tom Seaton with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game picked a release site where a group of bison cows has been browsing only a few days before. Workers cleared an alleyway through the riverside brush, and then the bulls were free to disembark. What happened next, according to Seaton, was not at all similar to the first release of bison in April, when the cows and calves stampeded out of their holding pen.
They've made about a 90-degree turn and walked off the barge onto the bank and up that alleyway, and they just did it real nice and slow. They'd stop and look back every now and then. We got to the very last one offloading up in the barge, and for whatever reason, he decided he didn't really want to come out. And so we opened up all the doors and tried to give him a little stimulus to come out, and he just said no. So we all just kind of went away and made everything as quiet as we could, and in about 20 minutes, he kind of just eased out on his own, did the same thing, walked down out the alleyway and into the meadow.
Aerial surveillance shortly after the release showed that a small group of bulls immediately honed in on the scent of the cows, while another chose to swim across the Onoco River in the opposite direction from the cows. Since then, satellite tracking collars show at least a few bulls have reunited with the cows and calves, and there's no evidence that any bulls have died in the transition to the wild. Another group of 18 bulls is scheduled to make a similar journey by barge beginning next week. A small group of wood bison remains in captivity at the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center in Portage, where the now wild wood bison were raised. Until this spring, wood bison had not roamed the wilds of Alaska for more than 100 years. Every year, millions of sockeye salmon return to Bristol Bay, headed for spawning grounds in area rivers. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has counting projects on several rivers throughout the region to give managers a sense of how many fish enter rivers to spawn. But less is known about what happens to outbound juvenile fish each spring. Research teams on three rivers that flow into Bristol Bay have been studying those baby fish, called smolt, for the past few years. KDLG's Molly Dishner checked in with the team studying smolt near the village of Igiagig and Lake Iliamna.
It's a little past 1 a.m. in Igiagig, and I'm headed down the Quidrac River to a fish trap set up to catch sockeye salmon smolt. Researchers from the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute are working on a study of smolt abundance, and the trap is how they collect fish each night to take a fin for genetic samples, scales for aging, and record certain information about the smolt, including lengths and weights. Smolt are juvenile salmon that have spent the first part of their life growing up in the freshwater. This is one of three sites where BBSRI is studying smolt in Bristol Bay, in partnership with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The information collected here, and at similar projects on the Ugashik and Igigik rivers, provides a picture of the conditions smolt are in as they swim downstream, leaving the lake where they've grown for the past year or two, headed for the ocean where they'll spend the next phase of their lives. Matt Namath is the project manager for BBSRI's smolt program.
Well, it's important to study smolt because it gives us an opportunity to see how the fish are doing halfway through their life cycle instead of waiting until the very end when they come back as adults. And if we have smolt data paired with the adult data that come back, then we can start to learn a lot more about the fish.
Eventually, when there's a better understanding of how smolt features correlate with the number of salmon swimming back, information on smolt could be used to help with run forecasts. But for tonight, we're just fishing in the dark. Namath says the crew captures smolt at night to try for a representative sample of the fish migrating downstream.
We capture the fish at night because that's when we can get the most representative sample of the fish that are going by. Most of the smolts emigrate at night, and we know from the sonar data that when they migrate at night, they're distributed unusually close to the surface, and that's where our trap is, and so we can capture the largest proportion of the run.
Back on the river, there's one last band of pink light ahead of us and a bright moon behind us. That's about as dark as it gets in a Geogic this time of year. Dirk Middleton and Chris Seawright pull the trap away from shore and start fishing. Logan Rave keeps the second boat ready in case it's needed to help move the trap. Once the trap is secure near the middle of the river, we pull in to wait. It's warm, and the crew keeps reminding me that I've lucked out on the weather. Smolts show up in the trap, and Chris explains how it works.
It's called an incline plant trap because it's got the incline that comes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're fishing further down in the front than in the back. It's almost like a sluice box, almost.
The trap fishes about 3 feet deep in a pretty fast section of river. Smolt typically run close to the surface at night when predators aren't out. The crew samples fish almost every night for the month that the project operates, trying to capture 600 sockeye smolt in about 2 hours. Tonight they're done much sooner. It's probably about an hour from the time we head down the river to the time we get back to the bunkhouse carrying 6 buckets with smolt in them. For KDLG, I'm Molly Dishner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The legislative deadlock over next year's state budget could impact valley crops. In fact, the Alaska Plant Materials Center in Palmer may soon have to look for alternative funding sources to keep its seed potato program going. Breanne Blackburn, a program manager at the Plant Materials Center, says it appears the seed potato program is safe for this year if the legislature decides on a budget.
So we do have funding to keep that program running through this upcoming fiscal year starting July 1, but that funding is limited through that fiscal year.
Blackburn says a one-time increment included in this year's budget pays for one full-time and one seasonal worker. She says the program could be in jeopardy beyond next year. The Plant Materials Center grows first-year seed potatoes, which are sought by growers worldwide for commercial production because they are certified disease-free.
Our seed potato program is the only place in Alaska where you can get certified seed potatoes in the state. And we participate nationally with the Potato Association of America and work with our partnerships all over the country. So it's an important program and one that we work hard to maintain.
Having to import seed potatoes into Alaska raises the risk of bringing in potato diseases. An Eagle River man started with a pile of junk, a roll of wire, and an obsession, and 10 years later ended up with art. KSKA's Ann Hillman checked it out.
Encased in plexiglass and the remains of an old satellite dish, a set of multicolored snooker balls are running an intricate obstacle course with no finish line.
We can pick that yellow ball. It's on its way up. I don't know where it's going to go.
That's the creator of the machine, John Will.
So that's the chain lift, and then it gets dropped off on that track. It goes through the first switch, and then the second switch. Of course, you see the next ball goes through. It goes a different route now because that switch switched. Yeah, we lost the yellow ball.
It's easy to lose track as the balls bank the curves, plow through chimes, and spiral down funnels. They trigger flashing toys from the 1980s and jump through loop-de-loops. Other than the wire tracks, everything is made from junk Will found around the house and garage.
That's a trash compactor. That's a gear out of a rear end of a big truck. That's the input shaft into an old transmission. There's a trailer hitch hanging underneath it. You see the ball down there?
Will never foresaw art in his future. He runs a pilot car company and rejuvenates septic systems. But in 2003, he saw an audio-kinetic sculpture by George Rhodes. It was a ball maze run with a motor, a chain, and gravity.
My head exploded right there. It just popped. I had to do it.
He says he became obsessed.
You know, I'd sit there and watch TV and I just, my eyes would be looking at it, but my mind wasn't, you know, so I'd have to get up and I couldn't sleep. It was freaky. I'd have to draw it on a piece of paper, and then it was out and it was gone. I can go to sleep, and then I didn't lose it, you know.
For 10 years, Will tinkered and tested to see what worked. Dust would get on the tracks, everything would go crazy, the timing would be off.
The same ball can go down the same track 500 times. And one time, it'll go flying across the room. You know, it's like, what caused that?
To figure it out, he set up a video camera on the machine to watch for abnormalities, then spend hours, days even, fixing the problems. He says the machine needs to run continuously for 2 or 3 weeks to see all of the combinations and possible issues. But now, his masterwork is finally out of his garage and on display at the Spark Gallery in downtown Anchorage. Will says he wants it to inspire people.
The ultimate thing is if you can inspire somebody, you know, just crack the egg somewhere or put a spark in their head and they can go on from there. God, that's the biggest gift anybody can give anybody, I think. But
it's the gift artist George Rhodes unknowingly gave John Will, and the gift Will hopes to pass on to other Alaskans. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Big ticket philanthropy usually goes like this. Charitable organization makes a pitch, donor writes a check. At least this is the way it's supposed to work. Carol Otis, a major benefactor of the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, is an outlier, as KCAW's Vanessa Walker recently discovered.
Allen Memorial Hall is a construction site. Sounds of wood sanders, table saws, and hammers emanate from the building. But over all of that noise, though, is the passionate voice of Carol Otis.
So, hi, how are you? So, we're looking at our stains.
With that unmistakable southern lilt.
And hopefully we'll have enough wood to finish the stage. Everything at this point is a hopefully. Whatever that means.
Originally from a small town outside of Birmingham, Alabama, Otis now spends several months a year in Sitka, mostly working on this building. That's how it's been for the past several years.
So I came into campus on a Saturday when they do their volunteer days, and Jerry Fleming, who used to own the paint store in town, was sweeping. And he gave me a broom and said, here, this is what you can do. Because I didn't know what I was capable of doing. So the broom has become my job.
Allen Memorial Hall and the theater inside of it were once condemned. Community members mobilized around the building and saved it from demolition in the 90s. It was stabilized and listed in the National Historic Register. But it simply was not a functional building anymore, despite its rich history at the heart of campus. Otis, who was just donating her sweeping skills one day, decided to take financial matters into her own hands. She made several significant financial contributions. That allowed the Sitka Fine Arts Camp to restore the 104-year-old building to mint condition.
What kind of angel funder would you see sweeping every day and cleaning up?
This is Sitka Fine Arts Camp Executive Director Roger Schmidt.
Forrest was doing all this drywall work up high on, you know, scaffolding. Well, Carol's pushing the scaffolding down around. She's just spending 8 hours in there just so he doesn't have to get down and up and down, and she's just pushing around the scaffolding. So she's really concerned about making her money go as far as her husband's money, the Otis family's money go as far as it can go, so that every dollar is stretched as far as it can. And she's just as much of a volunteer as any other volunteer we've had.
Since Otis spends much of her time at Allen Hall, she's become an expert in the construction process, donning a comfy sweatsuit every day.
Even though the light fixtures are modern, when you really look at them, they seem to be perfect in this room. Of the old wood and big high ceilings of wood, but they go well, don't they? Isn't that amazing?
Otis clearly has more of herself wrapped up in this building than just money. There are fond memories. She first visited Sitka a dozen years ago as a tourist, but that trip was a special one.
I came here in the beginning with my husband to go across to the other side to Baranoff Wilderness Lodge to have one last good trip. He was sick, and we knew he wasn't going to make it. So we came in June, and he died in November of that year.
Otis's husband was a doctor, and before he died, he asked that she donate some of the money he left behind towards causes that impact the greatest number of people. For her, Allen Hall was just that. In the years after he died, Sitka became her second home. Acquaintances quickly became friends. Those friends became family.
I don't know why it happened like this, but Sitka opened her hand and her heart to me. So I belong here.
Strictly speaking, the Otis Theater in Allen Hall bears the name of Carol's husband. But every corner of this building bears the personal stamp of her time, energy, and enthusiasm. And we mean every corner.
Is this not the most beautiful view you have ever seen in a ladies' restroom? So when I came, there was snow on top of the mountain there. So standing here and looking at the snow-capped mountain looked like somebody had stood there with powdered sugar and shook it on top. It was like, oh, God, that's so beautiful.
Carol Otis just has a way of finding beauty in the most unlikely places. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Vanessa Walker.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Francesca Fenzi in Nome, Tim Bedoni in Galena, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Vanessa Walker in Sitka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.